It's December 5th, 2008. I'm Mike Benedetti, and this is 508, a show about Western. Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Tina Zlody, Kevin Kassin, and Brendan Malikan. How is everybody doing?
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Great.
And Tina, this weekend is another one of the great art festivals that you mastermind, Start at the Station. Is that it?
Yeah, this is our winter event. It is Sunday at Union Station from 12 to 5. We have 78 really unique, interesting artists who will be selling their work. So, yeah, it should be fun.
Are there going to be any distinguishing things? I know that at Start on the Street, which unfortunately I missed the last one, there was something involving like a cardboard city of Worcester that was destroyed in an alley or something?
We had the block party, which was a continually evolving structure that eventually ended in collapse, and then and then a punk band played up, and it was fun. No, this is a much smaller sort of sedate show. It's very much directed towards shopping for the holidays, and directed towards really supporting the local small artist economy. It is very much a scaled down version. I think our two bigger events are the park in June, where we can bring in live bands and we can do a lot of activities, and September on Park Ave. So this is just, you know, music, food, wine, lots of friends, people sitting around talking, walking around, meeting each other. But there are not a lot of sort of interactive activities other than the act of shopping.
Seth Godin, the marketing guru, had a nice blog post about a week ago talking about holiday shopping. And he said this year, more than ever, your holiday dollars, you know, their impact is going to be high because there's going to be less money being spent. So, you know, what should you focus on? And one of his handful of things was buy handmade items that you like from people who you like. And this sounds like this is an opportunity to do that.
And our tagline this year, which is, you know, is so tantamount, is exactly that. Support your local economy, buy handmade, buy local. Don't go to Walmart. I mean, their numbers are up this year. Everybody else's numbers are down. So, and I think this way it also opens people's eyes to what is available. I think people are being much more thoughtful about, again, their dollar and what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I believe that, you know, people will come out and support the artists that are here. You know, are you going to be able to make it, or are you going to be leaving?
I will be here this Sunday, and I will definitely, I'm writing it in my calendar right now, 12 to 5,
all right.
Union Station, and which is a nice building. Is there anything in there now? Like, I know there was a restaurant, but it closed, and
Maxwell Silverman's is doing the catering for any of the functions that are there, so they'll be providing food. We'll have, their restaurant will be open, their bar will be open. So that's it. But other than that, it's pretty much an empty space that we're going to fill up with a few thousand people.
The perfect kind of place for a punk band to come up and play.
Quite honestly, with the acoustics in there, everyone's eardrums would bleed. That's one of the reasons. That's actually another component for this year that we've had to remove, was the bringing live bands into that space was an absolute nightmare. Anytime either a trumpet or drums were used, you couldn't actually hear the person across the room. So Paul Hatchie, our creative artistic director, has loaded his iPod for Bear, and we should have some fun with that.
Sounds good. I want to put a call out there. This isn't directed towards you, Tina, just towards the Worcester musicians in general. Somebody needs to get a busking license and be on the train platform. That's all
I agree completely. Yeah. I think that would be awesome.
Best dollar you can spend in Worcester.
It is, and it is only a dollar.
Yeah, for a year-long busking license. Pick your own spot.
There you go. So I hope folks come down.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. Tina, do you have anything else, or should I let you head off to work?
I'm just gonna go walk my dogs. Thanks, guys.
Alrighty, bye bye. Okay. So here we are.
Here we are.
Brendan.
Morning, Ben.
Kevin. I don't know what happened this week. I feel like Chacha had some good stuff, man. Chacha Connor was going to be on the show, but she can't be on the show. So now I kind of feel like the wind has been taken out of my sails.
That is a downer. I was looking forward to hearing that.
I wanted to mention that last week we were ridiculing Pilot, or as we call it now, Bilet, as being a never-ending, maybe it wasn't last week, it was 2 weekends ago, being a never-ending Groundhog Day kind of debate. This week, the pharmacy school announced that they would start making a $50,000 donation annually to the library, which falls under this whole Bilet scheme, and so, there you go.
Does it really, though?
You know, I don't know. I mean, this isn't exactly what I expected that this pilot program was going to look like.
I've always thought that the idea of pilot was to set forth a mandate that, like, whether or not it's left to the schools to make their own decisions, or, you know, they we come up with, like, each entity, we come up with a fixed figure or service to provide, it was at least a mandate from the city. This was a school saying, hey, we got some extra stuff here, it happened to be in the form of cash, mind if we fix up your library that, you know, nobody can ever figure out when it's actually open. Mm-hmm. And that's a really nice thing. That seems more like charity, which is pretty commonplace in the world. That's not the sort of, like, if I don't think the city council is in a position to congratulate itself or pat each other on the back for charity. Like,
they just raised a $50,000 annual donation for the next 20 odd years to the library. That's not a bad deal.
No, it's an awesome deal, but I don't think it really fits under that pilot umbrella in the spirit of what pilot is supposed to be. This is a gift, and we get gifts. That's an awesome gift. I'm not downplaying the gift, but I don't think it's fair to wrap it into the pilot sort of thing, because that's, again, that should be an ideology based on mandates,
But let's wrap it at least into a result of the pushing conversation back and forth. So certainly, as a community organizer, you push, and something happens. It's not oftentimes what you're expecting, but something happens, and I think the reason some of the institutions are stepping up around donations, charity, whatever, is because they're trying to find ways to do something to take the pressure off and the ongoing negative publicity.
Do you really think that's the case, though?
Yeah.
I mean, like, when I think of Clark, like, all of the work that Clark has done in that neighborhood, I don't in any way tie that together with, you know, the way that Jordan Levy used to react.
Right.
I mean, they're just making their neighborhood great. Or, like, the free tuition offers. That betters the community. That's straight up giving back to the community, which is what pilot is supposed to be all about. I guess I'm just, you know, pulling straws here, but
yesterday I saw Holy Cross, my alma mater, just started announcing this whole campaign they have called the Worcester Initiative, which is also discounted and free tuition for Worcester residents to come up to Holy Cross and what have you.
Cool.
And there's a whole kind of public launch with the shiny glossy brochures, et cetera, et cetera. So I agree. This is not pilot as it's defined, and I agree that these institutions probably would be doing some things. But the way they're announcing them and the way they're trying to get them out there is a way of saying, "Look, we're doing some stuff."
Yeah. No, I understand that. It seems like it's almost unfortunate that institutions that do a ton already are put in that position. I'm just old and cranky, Kevin.
Right. Well, I'm not. I'm right. I agree 100% with that.
It seems to me that an explicit long-term dollar commitment is different than the kinds of things that they've already been doing. It's kind of like at your job. You know, if you've got the difference between getting a $50 a month raise or getting a gym in work.
Yeah.
And the big difference there is that they can take the gym away, and it's not so noticeable as if they drop your salary, which people hate, right? I mean, this is like, you know, it's one criticism I've seen of the free tuition offers is that the dollar value of that free tuition offer or that tuition offer is not really reflected in what they actually put up, because, you know, you could make $1 billion in free tuition offers, and not everybody's going to take it up.
Right.
Not everybody's going to be eligible for it. So, you know, you have to look a little bit to figure out what that actual number is. You know, it's going to change from year to year. So it's the same kind of thing where, like, the kinds of services that they provide now are really big and way more important than some $50,000 a year, $1,000 a week donation to the library, as nice as that is. But, like, this kind of thing is the kind of thing that they can't go back on without getting a lot of negative publicity. Whereas if Holy Cross switches around their tuition offers, or Clark switches around some kind of neighborhood mentorship thing, which is worth much more than a $50,000 a year donation to the library, you know, like, there's just more games that can be played there, and it's just less obvious. It's harder to do the accounting on that.
Yeah.
I say let the city council take this victory, because the city council needs a victory, man. They're getting demoralized. They're getting, you know, they're losing faith. They're losing confidence in themselves.
You know, in fairness, when you make the comparison between money and tuition, that's what I always liked about the existing programs that some of the colleges had, like Clark, was that, you know, if you go to the Clark website and you look at the number of people who have actually, the number of students who have partaken in their, you know, the community school initiative, and that then parlays into the free tuition program, it's relative to the population, it's a non-existent number. it's embarrassingly small. And to me, that always said so much about Clark, that they're kind of like willing. They're sitting there waiting. Like, we are offering anybody who lives in this radius around the school free tuition, and that's not cheap tuition. And who takes them up? It's like nobody. And I mean, it screams volumes about the city that we're not actually willing to step up and take advantage of the things that already exist, yet we're willing to scream for more. I mean, I'm looking for the opportunity to move into that area to some degree now, simply because of the tuition initiatives. I mean, that becomes very helpful to me with a kid.
Well, let's just for clarity, the perception in the community around the Clark tuition is that you live within a radius and you have an opportunity to get this free tuition. As I understand it, unless they've changed it, the additional caveat is, and you attended the all school.
I think they are separated. I think they are separated now, but the all school is definitely connected to that program. I could have misread it, but either.
So I checked on that once because I had heard that from neighbors, like, I'm moving over there, whatever. And in my conversations with Jack, at that point, after a couple of years, there had been like 7 students or something that qualified.
It's still very, very low.
Right. But the first hoop the folks have to go to is graduating from the school, from the neighborhood school. So
right.
Certainly given the way with our desegregation plan in Worcester where people get shuttled all over the city, it's very possible to live in that neighborhood, not go to that school, and therefore not qualify.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's definitely a requirement as well to own property in the district as well. It can't just be, I don't think it's just a residential requirement. I think you have to own as well. But again, I'm talking on my ass, thoroughly making shit up, so...
Well, anyway, I have to say I'm also really think it's really cool that, again, it was after we ridiculed this as being a never-changing thing is when there was this tiny thing that happened, actually. So I'm just going to ridicule today's City Square. City Square, never going to change. Nothing's ever going to happen in City Square. And now watch as before Christmas, Young Park gives the city a special Christmas gift, as they would say. We're planning on the longest night. Kevin, you want to talk a little bit about the longest night, which is a national event about people who died homeless, and we're going to be recognizing 7 homeless Worcester residents who died in 2008 this year.
Yeah, so longest night is a national day of remembrance for people that were homeless and died homeless. Worcester celebrated it through the years. Over the last few years, Real Solutions has taken the lead on kind of organizing around that and pulling people out. Last year, we had a speak out and remembrance ceremony outside the auditorium where a man had been found, had died inside the auditorium trying to find a place to live over the winter, and then had the actual memorial service inside UCC Church. A couple of years before that, we were over at St. John's and back in City Hall, in front of City Hall. We had a couple of late-night sleepouts. But the idea from Real Solutions then is to continually remind ourselves that people are homeless, and the climate we've created in Worcester, this climate of hate against homeless people, is leading to a failure to assist people, a failure to take care of people, and they're dying. And so this year, what we've decided to do is hold... multiple vigils leading up to the memorial service. So on December 21st, which is the day, longest night, the day of remembrance, there'll be a memorial service at the BIP shelter, which everyone will be invited to. We're working on details exactly for what time. But there'll be a memorial service there. But on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday leading up to that, we'll be having 3 vigils at different locations across the city where homeless women died this past year. And so on Wednesday night at 5 o'clock, we'll be meeting outside the, on Green Street, outside the mural just below the YWCA. A young woman had died there this year in the kind of thickets behind the railroad tracks. The following day will be on Thursday, up by State Liquors on Park Avenue, where a woman died in the kind of small wooded area between State Liquors and Beaverbrook Park. And then on Friday, we'll be on Main Street, 856 Main Street, across from Dunkin' Donuts. I think a lot of folks know that that's there. I got some publicity in local media and stuff. So, sad,
stuff, Chance to Remember, Chance to Remind our neighbors that this is happening, but also a chance to voice some anger that this is should be intolerable in the city, and that the reason this is happening to a large extent, we have Real Solutions feels, is because of the climate we've created in this city against homeless people. And instead of dealing with homelessness and addressing homelessness, we continue to demonize and to put down. So we'll stop there.
Thanks for mentioning that. Thanks for all the work that you're doing on this. I'm actually doing very little work on it this year. So thanks. I'm glad that you guys are all taking care of it, though. I have two things on my list. Brendan, do you have anything on your mind this week?
Yeah, I got a lot on my mind this week, Mike, right. But I'm not going to bore you with any of it. It's something that I just noticed scrolling through the Telegram paper today that we finally have a contract with our new superintendent. And it's a pretty standard contract, I mean, for what contracts are. But there are contracts are really interesting things, and I find myself fascinated by them on a regular basis. So $180,000, that's what we're paying our new superintendent, which is where we left off with our last superintendent. I cannot for the life of me begin to figure out how in the public sector, starting salary always seems to line up nicely with ending salary of the person you're replacing. In the private sector, it seems to be the exact opposite. You go back to square one. But in the public sector, it's just like this one long string that runs off into infinity. We're paying $550 a month for a reimbursement on a leased vehicle. That is a really nice car for a public employee. If you figure in a lease, it's not purchasing. That explains, if you look around, if you wonder why there are so many Lexuses that find themselves in public parking lots, it's because we pay for tons of leasing. Cell phone, which is nice. That's a nice perk.
So and then beyond that, we get the other technology reimbursements is a home fax machine, a laptop computer, and a home printer.
A home fax machine?
Well, you know, the fax might actually come in handy, but what I don't get is...
Do they give them a butter churn, too? A fax machine?
That's what I was going to say.
Why are we hiring a person who doesn't already have their own computer to be running our education initiatives for the city? Like, wouldn't that be...
Who uses a fax machine in this day and age?
I have no idea who uses a fax machine. I have no idea who, you know, takes $180,000... Who's in a position to take a $180,000 job and doesn't already own their own laptop. Man. You know, you'd think that would be that's one of the things you would have bought on your way up the ladder, maybe when you hit the $70,000 a year wrong. I don't know. But so we got the car, we got the technology, but what we also have that's very interesting here, and I don't think we've done this before, a severance package in the contract. So if we fire our new superintendent of schools, we still pay her for 18 months, unless she gets fired for criminal behavior or moral turpitude. I have no idea what moral turpitude is. I assume I'm not eligible for a severance package from the city minister. But that just seems crazy. 18 months, which I think is almost how long it's taken us to find a new superintendent of school, we can be guaranteed that next time around we'll be paying our existing superintendent, if we did in fact fire this person. I'm not saying we would have any reason to, but if we did, we'd be paying her in parallel to the replacement, and her replacement would probably be starting at the same salary she'd be ending at. So we would find ourselves in a bizarre position where now we're paying, what, $400,000 a year in salaries for people who don't even work here, which is great. It's a good deal. Congratulations, Worcester, new superintendent of schools.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you about your friend Officer Rojas, who's been in the news again this week.
You know, Mike, I had an actually funny idea this morning. I was thinking that since, you know, we still don't have these records, if Kevin could just recite to us his complaint against Officer Rojas, we actually could, maybe the Telegram Gazette could get a jump on their story.
My complaint's been online since day one.
Oh, shit.
Kevin is distinguished as one of the few people with a complaint against Rojas that doesn't involve being punched.
Or shot.
That
dog can complain himself.
Well, anyway. I guess one thing we could do is we could take wages now on whether a week from now these files are going to get released or not. You know, it seems unexpected and unbelievable to me that all of a sudden there's an outside entity that has oversight over the release of these files or not.
And I thought this was just an objection being set up by the union's lawyer.
Yeah,
no, the police union agreed to it.
You know, I've read public record law, and I don't remember the line that says, if a union or an outside entity feels that, like, these should, a public record should not be released, then they should be held.
Yeah, this is the sort of this part of the process should have taken place at the beginning of the process. Like, the first people to see the records back in April, when it was supposed to take 10 days for them to get released, would have been his attorneys, if he requested his attorneys from the union to be involved, which is fine. I mean, the union can do that at his request, but they can't, like you said, in any way hold up the actual process. I mean, we've gone from 10 days to 6 months apparently now in rewriting case law for the state. And now we have this added pearl of, you know, like, third parties that have, not even quasi-public entities, like fully private entities, membership-driven entities, are now able to inject themselves, apparently, into public records law.
I got two more things. I'll mention one of them, then give you guys a chance to say something. One of them is that my case study on Worcester Online Journalism, I started working on part two yesterday. This is a project looking at the amount of local news in the Telegram and Gazette versus the amount of local news on blogs or commercial sites that don't depend on print advertising. The idea not being to say you should get your news from the internet rather than by subscribing to the Telegram and Gazette, because the TNG, I think, still is a much, you know, better source of news than checking a bunch of blogs if you're going to pick one or the other. It's basically to say that the Telegram and Gazette is not going to remain unscathed. Right? I mean, it hasn't been unscathed so far by economic problems, and it's just going. There's no sign that it's doing anything other than going downhill, and that 10 years from now, you're not going to have a daily paper like you think of it in Worcester. So where are the alternatives at as of now? Are they in any position to ramp up in a couple of years and take over this responsibility? The answer seems to still be no. This last one I did from yesterday, I found the TNG had three local features, which certainly, you know, local features on Worcester websites compete with that quite well, especially in quality of the work. But there were 9 news stories. About half of them were crime stories. Maybe one or two local news stories that I found that came from outside the Telegram yesterday. And again, it's especially these kinds of stories about crime, local government, local schools, and local sports that, you know, the local paper is traditionally just has a monopoly on these things. So anyway, there you go. But it's not like we were saying, like, I think we were originally talking about, you know, is the blogosphere at something like 1% the capacity of the Telegram and Gazette? And the answer actually seems to be, to me, that the blogosphere is maybe between 10 and 20% of the capacity of the Telegram and Gazette. Again, not doing well on crime stories. Not a lot of investigative journalism coming out of the blogosphere locally either. But on just sort of random stuff around town, which, again, is mostly what the Telegram and Gazette's putting in their news stories, the blogosphere is doing okay, you know. The blogosphere is a far distant second if you're going to, but at least it's in the game somewhere. Worcester Magazine, by the way, actually doing quite well, in my opinion, on this for a free weekly, the amount of news that they have.
And I think we have a hell of a lot more fun than the Telegram and Gazette does, though, Mike.
Well, that's the rule. The whole job of a journalist is to write about things you don't care about, right? Right. I mean, you can tell this by reading the articles. Like, it's all like, I really, you know, it's like, blah, 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 Holy Name Wind Turbine, I really don't care.
I had an opportunity to talk to Sean Suttner for a while yesterday from the TNG, and he confirmed what I'd noticed off their webpage recently, is that within the TNG news department, they've set up an investigative unit. And so Jay Worley, who's a friend to some of us, he did work with us a lot on public record stuff and Sunshine Law stuff a few years ago.
A great guy.
He's heading up the investigative unit. And Sean and Tom Kaywood are the other two reporters in that unit. So there's some hesitance on management part of publicly announcing the I-team in some ways or what have you, but those two guys are assigned to an investigative unit, and that's their beat, is to do investigative journalism right now. And I think that reflects kind of what some of us have been seeing. It just feels like there has been some quality investigative journalism out of the TNG recently.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a good sign, because I think we've all felt that's, you know, that is where the TNG needs to be looking to move forward. You know, this is their resources allow them to do that, where it is harder for the blogosphere.
Oh, absolutely. We just don't have. There's nobody out here on this side of things that has that kind of access. You know, universal access. And it, right. You know, the other thing that's going to be interesting too is to see how the public reacts. It's been so long. You know, I can't remember. I mean, it's been so long for the Telegram to have had, you know, like a dedicated police reporter, like a two-way police reporter, you know, real, like, real nonstop City Hall coverage. Mm-hmm. A lot of those lines of communication have broken down, but more importantly, the expectation of the public. Something tells me that there's a lot of the readership that actually enjoys when we have, you know, front page stories about local turkey populations and not, you know, local stories that are real hard investigative journalism. It's going to be interesting to see how people react to that and that change. It's really just going back to what we used to have, which was great. I'm always interested to see how the customer base responds.
I'm glad that they're creating more of that product, because that's the kind of product that I value. I don't know if the marketplace values that. I guess that's my core worry here.
Yeah, I don't know that. Something tells me that there is a lot of the readership that, you know, maybe this is why one of the bigger components of newspapers shrinking. That, you know, there's a lot of people like the PR kind of stuff. You know, that isn't really, you know, there's not stories that make you itchy a little bit, right? I mean, stuff that is comfortable and more family friendly, and you know, that seems to be what, as an industry, you've had these like middle tier newspapers focus on. And personally, I think it's awesome that we're getting back to, you know, real reporting. Even if resources are getting cut down, we're starting to focus back on the things that are important local news.
But I think in the short run, I think this one of the things with the public records in Rojas is that it's going to change the police reporting from the TNG side. So the agrimony between those two bodies right now is such high that the TNG isn't going to just do the usual go to the police department press conference and copy down what they said articles any longer for a while. So at least in the short run, I think it's going to change the way the TNG reports on police matters, the whole Rojas public records thing, because there's such agrimony now between both the police department and TNG that the usual send the reporter over to the police department for the press conference and copy down what they said isn't going to play out in the same way.
You know, I was just thinking about the crime news as being the one thing where, again, nobody in the blogosphere is even like in the slightest position to do that kind of news. I'm wondering to what extent, you know, as the local daily paper fades away, if maybe at some point there isn't a call. I don't know that this has ever happened in any city. This is just totally off the top of my head, sort of a local call to say, in the interest of transparency in local government and local police, we need to have, you know, we need to hire an additional police spokesperson whose job is to, you know, type up on the internet, blog, if you will, you know, the day's police activity, right? Which does not at all replace the local reporter, because it's a completely, you know, like, to the extent that police stuff is going to be biased, it's going to be a completely biased source of news, and you're going to have to worry about, you know, are things being covered up or whatever, but at least sort of gives people a chance to start thinking about that who don't have contacts inside the police department.
That was always a bizarre, I always thought it was bizarre the way we handle PR for the police department now, where we have a police officer as the police spokesperson. I always thought that would be a much better way to, you know, kind of like an olive branch, so to speak, to have a civilian press spokesperson for the police department.
Yeah.
So you didn't ever have to have that feeling that you were dealing with somebody whose voice was really speaking for, whether it be administration or particular officers or officers as a whole, that you never get that feeling. This was just like some guy who has, you know, he's a career PR guy, and, you know, it still might all be bullshit, but at least it's bullshit that isn't directly related to like a union or, you know, an administrative body. It's
right.
It's separate from that body.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so there's my two bits on local journalism this week. Again, this is not a call to say to people, do not subscribe to the Telegram and Gazette, that the Telegram and Gazette is somehow worthless. This is just saying, in the event that the Telegram and Gazette goes away, where are we at? And the answer is, we got a long way to go.
Yeah.
This week, the city manager gave a shout-out to Colin Novick on the city council meeting, and I want to play a little audio from that at the end of the show. Do you guys have anything else, though, before we do that?
I don't think so.
Nothing.
Nothing on my end right now.
Nothing that you're excited about in the city.
I'm excited about everything in my city.
I feel like sometimes all we do is complain on this show and talk, dwell on the negative. Like, I don't know. I'm very up on Worcester this week. I'm excited about this start in the station thing. I'm excited HBML is going to have another free coffee day tomorrow. If people want to go down to 420 Pleasant Street Saturday afternoon, get yourself a cup of free coffee, hang out with the young children. as Rosalie Chola said, you know, this marijuana decriminalization is going to embolden the punks, and that's probably the best place for you as a member of the general public to run into the punks who have been newly emboldened there at HBML.
So emboldened.
Worth checking out. Anyway, there you go. All right, guys. Well, thanks for talking to me, and here is City Manager Michael O'Brien.
Madam Chairperson, just briefly, there's an individual that needs to be recognized that is a force of one in so many ways, but has got the support of the entire environmental community here in our great city, and he is the director of the Greater Worcester Land Trust. It's Colin Novick, who knows how to weave in and through the seams of state government and how the city government works with direct contacts when necessary to me to ensure that even with the challenges a project like this would present, and there's two great sites here that we're talking about, we can accomplish the goal. And I'm very grateful for his stewardship on the private side through the Greater Worcester Land Trust. I would say this, and I mean it sincerely, we can't do it without him, how well he operates in making sure we dot the I's and cross the T's in very complex transactions, with the Greater Worcester Land Trust putting the money where their mouth is.
Thank you.